This is Live Wild's Connection Matters podcast, bringing together heart-centered, nature-connected, curious people who share the inquiry, how can we create a connected and meaningful way of living that brings more health, happiness and growth to our world? My name is Leona Johnson and I am your host. Hey beautiful humans, welcome to episode 21 of Connection Matters podcast. How are you today? I hope you're well wherever you are. It's turn of the season time. Autumn up here in the northern hemisphere and coming into or out of spring into summer, I guess, down in the southern hemisphere. I'm feeling a little bit discombobulated at the moment, finding it hard to get going and get things get things happening. Do you find that sometimes? It's quite unusual for me, and it's also not related to anything particular. I'm quite well in heart, mind, body and spirit, but just not so action focused. So yeah, just sitting with that a little bit today. I am happy to be here though, and I'm happy to be sharing this conversation with Ali Chone, because she is an amazing woman actually, who does such brilliant work with children and adults in her work as a play therapist and in setting up the organisation, the Collaboration of Outdoor Play Therapists, which I am a part of, and she's also my supervisor for when I do one-to-one therapy suit work with children and as an eco-therapist. And that's been really great for me actually, to have other elders, mentors, people who are pioneering this work of outdoor connection based work and really bringing it into the mainstream. Is exciting, you know, play therapy and ecotherapy and working with people in the outdoors for therapeutic benefit. That's not an unusual thing anymore. It's not an alternative thing. It's mainstream and it's needed and it's happening, and it's really great to be part of a group of people with amazing women who are part of it, Ali Chone being one of them. So I hope that you enjoy this episode today. Also, I would like to just draw your attention to the Patreon account, www.patreon.com/connectionmatterspodcast. If you are enjoying the show and you're in a position to support us, we do really need the support of our patrons. For as little as £3 a month, you do get some downloads and some freebies from our guests, and every now and then a little message from me and ways of staying in connection. So I really appreciate all those who are already supporting us, and for those who are thinking about it, then please go for it, because these times are hard actually, and our business has been really badly affected, and this podcast is an offering to the world. We're not doing it for money, but ultimately money is needed to make things happen, and yeah, it's much appreciated. Also, I would like to draw your attention to the Instagram and Facebook groups and all the other ways of connecting with us, which you can see in the show notes to this episode, because it's so good to hear from you. I really love any feedback, any comments. You know, do feel free to email me at connectionmatterspodcast at livewild.org.uk. And I'm really happy to talk about any of the things that we discussed during any of the episodes, and I'll get back to you if I possibly can. So yeah, looking forward to the next few weeks. We've got some great episodes coming up, and without further ado, this is Ali Chone. Hi Ali.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming and speaking to me for Connection Matters. It's really nice to see your face, although I know others at home can't see your face. So welcome, and I always like to start with sharing some gratitude. So I think today, what I'm really grateful for, my son has gone off to the holiday club that Live Wild runs. Live Wild's the organisation that I run, and he's gone, and he's 9.5 years old, and he's been coming since he was four with me, dragging him along, and I'm not running them anymore, but the other amazing practitioners that work with us are. And he's still really happy to go. And I just love that his connection to nature is so alive that he's really excited still to go and be in those woods that we've been in for so many years, doing fire and climbing trees and connecting with other children and all of those things. So I'm really grateful for that exists, that my son can go to it and that he's still getting a lot out of it. And also that my daughter, she's gone off to her old childminder, and I'm paying for her to go off to her old childminder, not because she needs to be there, but because they've just got such a close and strong attachment. Mm. And she went to her childminder for when she was one, and she's now seven. And I know that it means so much to both of them. Like, Louise is an amazing, really child-centered human, and my daughter was the first child that she childminded. So they've got this really close and special relationship, and she was really pleased that she wasn't going to have any other children today, that they could just spend the day together. And I feel like I'm sending her off to a grandparent, you know, and just so very lucky that they are happy, healthy children, and that they go off happily, and that I can be here to do this work, which I also love, which is me connecting to others.
I was just thinking then, as you spoke about, yes, going off into the woods to have a campfire. There's nothing finer, I don't think, than a fire and joining other people around one. And I'm grateful today for the sun, which is streaming in through the window and causing me to actually close my eyes, but I'm not going to shut the sun out. I think I was probably a reptile in a former life, because I can just feel my energy and my life force being revived by the feel of sunshine on my skin, and the prospect of doesn't have to be an entirely sunny day, just a glimpse of the sun every day and to feel its warmth is really important to me. I'm not good on grey flat days. I kind of feel that I have to push the sky up away from me, and one of the reasons I like living by the sea is because we have this really big open horizon ahead of us, and I love hills and I love walking in hills, but I'm not great at walking in particularly coniferous forests, because I'm definitely best placed where I can see into the distance, and I have that sense of space and air around me. And today, not only is the sun streaming through my window, but it's showing off the trees in the garden opposite. It's showing off the autumn colours to perfection. So that's where my gratitude is today.
Oh, I love that so much. And I'm totally with you. I try to embrace all weathers. And in my job, in our jobs, you do have to do that. But I really love the sunshine. I really love that feeling of the warmth on my skin, and just that, yeah, that energy that, you know, is in everything. So beautiful. So thank you. And I can see the sun shining on your face there. And I'm slightly jealous, because it is a very grey and soggy day here. But but yeah, it's actually reminded me, I'm currently doing some work with Annie Spencer, who I have already, is one of the other podcast people I've spoken to, and I've worked with her for years. But I've just started working with her again, and one of the practices that she's got us doing is going out every morning at sunrise and just welcoming the sun as, you know, just to be in connection with each day, each new day, and how precious and amazing that is, you know, that the sun has risen again, that that golden sphere, that beautiful heat and electric ball of energy has come again to give us a new day, and just how precious that is. So I'm on day two of this practice that I'm committing to try and do, and it, you know, it will get easier through the winter as the sunrise, the time of the sunrise gets later and later in the day. But actually, I wonder how I'll go in the spring and midsummer. I'm not very good in the morning at the best of times. So
I'm very lucky because I can lie in my bed, and if the blind is up, I can see the hills which lie to the east of me. Not dead east, so I can't actually see the sun rise at the moment, but I can tell what the quality of the day is going to be weather-wise, whether I turn over and close my eyes because it's grey and wet, resting in my bed, or whether I get up and greet the day because it looks like it will be a day where I can actually get out into the garden. My garden is soggy and sodden at the moment, and I'm trying to find the motivation and the energy to get out there and do a bit of autumn garden work.
Yeah, I think it's harder at this time of year than it is sometimes later on in the winter, because we've lost the sun, and we've, you know, and the summer has ended, and so my instinct is to want to get cozy quite quickly, and really we do need that daily dose, or at least, you know, regular dose of outdoors, don't we? And I think it does benefit us to make ourselves get out there sometimes.
Yeah.
So I've invited you here, Ali, because I know the work that you do, and because we have so much in common, and I hope that we will have a very nourishing conversation between the two of us, but that also others will enjoy, because you are a play therapist, and I have your book, Play Therapy in the Outdoors, and I've been coming to you for supervision for the work that I do as an ecotherapist, for the work that I do with young people. And I just love that play therapy in the outdoors is actually even a thing now, because I didn't know it was a thing like only a year ago, actually, and it is a thing. So I'm wondering if you'd like to tell us more about that, what about your work and what it is that you do.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity of being able to share it with a new audience as well, because traditionally play therapy has taken place in a playroom, generally inside an organisation. It might be a school, it might be a CAMHS, child and adolescent mental health setting. It can be in places such as the NSPCC, but it's taken place in a room, and that in order to preserve the confidentiality of the work, that room is just a space that the therapist and the child work. And that's absolutely right, that children need to be accorded a space that is safe, where they're able to process difficult life experiences. And I trained at Roehampton, and there was a point in my training. I can probably tell this story now, because a significant time has passed since I trained, but I had my knuckles wrapped because I was working with a boy in a playroom in a school, and it was a very small room inside a bigger room. And when you work in schools, you can do all the work that you need to remind staff that this is a space that shouldn't be intruded upon. But with the best will in the world, they have busy days when sometimes they forget. So we were very safe in our small room inside a bigger room, because if a member of staff came into the bigger room, I could motion through the door that they weren't to enter our small space. But I'd been working with a boy who had spent probably 10 weeks sitting with his back to me. He'd been using some of the Small World toys, and the toys were lined up in very rigid order, but he found it so difficult to actually turn and engage with me. And I had taken that to supervision and had some ideas for how I might increase that engagement. And we started trying to play hide and seek in a very small room. And I'm quite a big person, so there was nowhere I could hide. And even he found it quite tricky. And one day he said to me, "Can I hide in the other room?" And he stepped outside the door. So we were still within our kind of preserved space, but he was outside what had been determined as our playroom. And this was deemed by my seniors to have broken the idea of confidentiality. Now, when you're training for anything, you need to learn from your seniors and those who are training you. And it did cause me to reflect on actually what the space was. How did we determine what the playroom was? And it struck me that it was a very adult determined thing. I work in a room that a school has that's empty. I don't often have a lot of say in precisely which room. I can say what I need to have in a room if possible. So it got me thinking that actually for a form of therapy that was designed to create a safe space for children, and a branch of therapy that worked through play rather than through verbal communication, because play is seen as the child's natural form of communication, we were actually working in a very unnatural space. And that was actually the starting point of my thinking about moving outdoors. It was more about the fact that I felt it was a very undemocratic space. And that if you actually ask children where they'd like to be, the majority of the time they say they want to be outside. So it felt to me like in being told that I shouldn't have allowed him to step into that larger room, I was also actually blocking something that was really important for him, which was that he was prepared, after having spent weeks of not being able to engage with me, to engage with a place and to experiment with being outside that kind of very small womb-like safe area into a bigger space. It was almost rebirthing would be far too strong a concept, but it was like he was prepared to test himself, to test his newfound self. And from there I got to just thinking about why, if we think that play, or we understand that play is a child's natural form of communication, why are we then working in areas which within a room that is actually an unnatural setting for a child? Now, this was quite radical thinking, I have to say, at the time. And I could almost metaphorically have been slapping myself on the wrist to say, no, you don't think like that. Because therapy in general is steeped in the tradition of the psychotherapy of Freud, really. It's been described as you work in a box inside a box inside a box. You work in a room inside a building inside an organization. And it also felt for me very, I have this kind of concept about masculine systems that are very boxed and evidence-based and scientific and, dare I say, sterile, that they're so carefully controlled and contained that they actually are a sterile environment. And so that got me started on the journey of thinking, where else might therapy take place? So rather than coming from a position of wanting children to reconnect with nature at that point, it was about that idea of, where is there a more democratic space? which is not determined by me or the organisation, but is a space that belongs to both of us, but to neither of us. And I don't think I'm the first person to have coined that phrase. So the outdoors, working in nature, doesn't belong to me. It belongs to both of us. Mm. But yet it belongs to neither of us. Mm. So I guess I came to it from that perspective, which is you know, different to the nature connection perspective. But then that has become a really integral part of the work that I've been doing. Mm. And it was I was described by somebody as having pioneered this pathway, and I don't know, like a lot of women of my generation, I guess, you know, we don't tend to blow our own trumpets, but actually I'm quite proud of that title now. To have been a pioneer in this. And of course there are lots of people who are writing about the need for connection with nature. I don't know if you know the book that Richard Louv published back in the early 2000s, Last Child in the Woods.
Yeah, amazing book.
And you know, that kind of really got me thinking about, I've arrived at the idea of working outdoors from that perspective I've just described, but is there something else within me that has been supporting that move out there?
Mm. And that's... Well, and that to me is what is so exciting and pioneering. And thank you so much for your bravery in listening to yourself and actually, you know, going against the grain and really thinking beyond those parameters that have been set for you by a really amazing profession, which itself is still fairly new in the grand scheme of things, people really understanding the therapeutic value of play and the healing value of play, mm-hmm. and being with a therapist in play, more than just, you know, children need play, which we do all need, and are all still trying to, I still think there are institutions that are still trying to grasp that, namely our very confused education system, let's say. But yeah, to actually then take that step into the outdoors, which for me is obviously, as you know, where my passion lies, because I've come from the other way round at it in some ways, because I started as you know, moving into forest school and then moving into therapy that, you know, I believe that nature connection is inherently therapeutic for everyone and all of us, and yet there is a very particular and amazing thing that happens whenever you can work with people who are trying to process difficult life experiences, and you can do that in a natural setting where you know, particularly we're talking about play children, you know, that where they can actually be with another caring, experienced and trained human who will be able to support that play and help them work through things. And it's very exciting for me, and it feels to me like we're in a real exciting time. I just want to share a bit about the conference actually at the weekend. So one of the things that Ali does for the listeners at home is has set up this organisation called the Collaboration of Outdoor Play Therapists, COOPT. And on Saturday, there was an online conference. It was meant to be an in-person gathering, but as we're in the time of COVID and many things have had to move online, we chose to do a three-hour online conference, and it was so exciting for me to be included in that group of really amazing humans who are doing really exciting, innovative work with young people in the outdoors. And how do you feel about how that conference was and how it went?
Yeah, I was really pleased with the number of participants we had in it. And as you say, originally we were actually going to run what we were calling our first camp over conference, and that was going to be in part about sharing our collective knowledge in terms of a training event, but also offering people the opportunity to strengthen their own connections by being in a space with other like-minded people around the campfire, because I do think campfires are a really key element of reconnecting with the outdoors. They provide a kind of focus, and I think for all humans, we understand the importance of fire to our ability to live wild as well. And yes, so we were going to have that opportunity, and I was so looking forward to sitting around the campfire with everybody. And being online was not quite how it was supposed to be, but there we were. And I'm just heartened by the number of newbies, as I call them, and that's a very affectionate term, who contact me and say, I want to work in the outdoors, but I'm not sure how to get started. And I have conversations online with people. And I felt that there was a real sense of us being united in an adventure, I'll call it. I think you might use the term quest possibly, but I would say we're on a kind of adventurous pathway, because I certainly don't know all there is to know about working in the outdoors. I know it from my own perspective, but perspectives such as your particularly strong nature connection perspective, and we had Lucy Llewellyn on board with us, who works with Tracy Farr Thompson and Ries van Fleet, and they work with animal assisted therapy. And we have actually had a cooped gathering day where we had a friend of mine who's a therapist who is an animal assisted therapist, and she came along with her therapy dog and worked with us for the morning. Mm. So it's delightful to know that I've kind of pioneered a pathway that people want to follow. But I have to say that I probably arrived at that point where I felt not only was working outside the right thing for children and young people, but also, we did need to work on that reconnection with nature, because the disconnection troubles me very deeply. And as I was saying to you earlier, I've been a sort of low-level political activist for most of my life, and the tension for me is between living what I preach, if you like, and also knowing that just working on our own connections, which is so vitally important, is not the sole answer to broadening the sense of connection that is needed, that we do need. It has to be supported with changes to the economic and social policies that we have. And you know, capitalism is so skillful at hooking us all into the materialism that exists, which is what provides the disconnect, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's because of the way that we live, because of the way that we, you know, that we have to earn enough money to live in these houses, these boxes, that so that we can move to our cars, which are these boxes that move us to our offices or our places of work in boxes. And we're missing the wavy edges, aren't we? We're missing that space. We're missing the opportunity to feel the weather and have to endure the weather sometimes and have to be in connection with the cycles of life that really bring us into the present moment, I think. One thing I noticed that lockdown did was stopped me, and now still I'm in it, this stopped me planning everything a year in advance. You know, I had so much in my diary that everything, every weekend was planned out until, you know, and in March that all changed. And I was, for the first time, forced just to be at home and in the present moment. And one thing I did that really helped me, thankfully, was disconnect from the internet for a few weeks.
Yeah.
Well, because otherwise I think I would have tried to keep up somehow by doing all of the online stuff. And then it just brought me into the here and now with my children, and we just played and we went out every day and we were in nature. And obviously that's what I do a lot anyway, but even me, who is so committed to living in a more nature connected way, I realized how absolutely I wasn't, and how caught up I was with I was just doing the same as everybody else, but my work and job was nature connection work. It was still really disconnected in a way that I was bound by, and you know, still am, because that's the world we live in, by having to earn more money than is very easy to earn, and get things that I, you know, what my kids want and to some extent need, but not necessarily. And yeah, and it is so disconnecting, and we're actually at that time where we feel, where we're all really searching, I think people are searching for something more, we don't really know what that looks like, because nobody wants to go back to live in mud huts. Well, not nobody, but but really it's not about becoming primitive. We've come so far in terms of technology and science and knowledge, but how do we turn that to be living a more healthy and balanced way of life, where we're actually part of the solution and regenerating the world rather than depleting it and taking. I wonder what that looks like.
Yeah, it's I think one of the key things that the connection or the disconnection has done is it's broken that link we have with the cycles of the land. You know, when I was a child, I grew up in a house where my parents were quite religious, and we attended chapel, and we used to go to Harvest Festival. And I remember my father used to get hold of a mushroom basket. Now, when you bought mushrooms in shops in my day, they didn't come in plastic packages. The mushrooms were in like a cardboard basket with a metal handle, and they would be taken from that and weighed for you. So my father used to get hold of those mushroom baskets, and we would decorate them, and then we would put produce from our garden in that and decorate the handle with flowers, and we would take that along to the Harvest Festival service, and we would give thanks for the harvest. And that was part of the kind of turning of the year. Harvest was around about this time of year, and we turned into the winter months. And then we had services in the spring to welcome the spring and the planting time again. Now, those of us that garden, and I'm a keen gardener, I'm not a particularly knowledgeable gardener. These seeds look interesting, let's pop them in and see what happens. But we do grow quite a bit of our own vegetables, and we're branching out into fruit trees. And that, knowing the cycle of how things come into being, I think is a really key point for children particularly. And I know when I listened to the podcast with Anne, and she was talking about children not understanding that the meat that they buy comes from an animal. And I think that idea that you plant a seed and a carrot grows, and actually all you have to do is tend it and nurture it, is such a strong metaphor for us in society, that if we want to get back to, we want to reestablish that connection, we need to be in tune with the cycles of growing and of the land. And one of the things that I think has happened in schools in a number of areas is the establishment of a school garden, where they do actually grow produce that they can then use in the kitchen. So they're beginning to give children that understanding. But that connection with how the year turns, and I really love that phrase, the turning of the year. Mm-hmm. So it turns from harvest into winter, and it turns into spring, and it turns into summer. And I think, technology is, it's good, because it has enabled people who would otherwise have been very isolated during lockdown, for example, to remain connected. But we, what we've all come through with, I think, is that notion that connections have to be real. As you've said, they have to be in the here and now. They have to be tangible and touchable to really have that depth of meaning for us. And so I suppose one of the aspects of that has developed in the play therapy and the outdoor movement is the idea that we are trying to support that reconnection of children and young people to the natural cycles that there are. Mm. And that actually nature is a therapist. She's a free therapist.
Mm.
And if we can encourage them to take time to be there, and not just to use the natural setting, but actually to really feel themselves in it. I think Robert McFarlane, who I don't know if you know his work, mm. he writes a lot, particularly about the old ways, and he has a lovely book on holloways, those lanes, deep sunken lanes. Oh. It's a little book actually, yep. Very small one. And he says of children that they're never on the land, they're in the land, and they're, you know, as if they were animals burrowing in it. And I think that's one of the things that when we move our work outside, we give them the opportunity to do, to really become part of the environment that we're working in. Mm. And to get their hands dirty and to feel that dirt and mud in their, between their fingers. Mm. Because that, I if I'm feeling troubled or anxious or overwhelmed, walking works for me, swimming in the sea works for me, but putting my hands in soil works for me every time.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter whether it's in my garden or in a bag of compost, just that actual physical connection with the earth is what really regrounds me.
Mm.
Immersion in water, the rhythm of walking on the land and being part of it,
mm-hmm.
and that feeling that soil in my hands. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's what we can kind of encourage in the young people we work with, is that really embodied connection, because that's the area of work that I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
Hugh and I were talking earlier about how in trauma is held within our sensory system, and so we need sensory experiences to be able to process that. We can't do it verbally in the same way, and obviously being outside is a significant aspect of that. Mm. And there's something very visceral for me about the way nature changes. So at the weekend, I was looking with people at how working on a beach can provide opportunities for therapeutic storytelling, for example. But one of the real strengths that I think nature offers us is the concrete example of change. Because the young people that we work with, they have to have hope that things can change.
Mm.
Both for themselves, that they can change themselves, but also that things around them can change, and that they have the power to be part of changing things. And I think it's quite tricky to understand just how powerful change can be without a concrete example. So my classic example is the day I shot my video, the sea was fairly benign. It was on the Devon coast, so there are always there's always surf, but sometimes it's quite low surf. And then other days you can go and the sea is raging and boiling. And I think for young children particularly, to be able to draw on that to illustrate that we are very much like that, because we are part of nature. So we have raging days within us. We have days when we're troubled and we're boiling and we're angry, but we can then find a way to release that or process that and become like the calm sea.
Mm.
So that for me is a very strong metaphor, but it works in the woods as well. And you have days when the trees are still and the leaves just are just hanging there, quietly minding their own business. And then you have days when the wind is strong and the leaves are torn off and everything is tumultuous.
Mm.
And I was actually talking to my partner this morning because about the wind, because we live up a slight hill in Weymouth and we've been here about, just over 18 months now. And it seems to me to always be windy. And I was saying, is it my imagination? Or has the world got windier over the last decade? Because that in itself, to me, just represents the torment that nature is in. You know, it's constantly being beaten and battered by us.
Mm-hmm.
And we really have to take stock of what we're doing and replenish.
Mm-hmm.
Not just ourselves, but try to replenish the environments that we're destroying as well.
Mm. Oh gosh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. Oh, there's so many things there that I love, and absolutely, nature, being in nature, nature is life. We are nature, and life happening around us when we're not insulated from it, from the you know, by being indoors all the time, just really, it does just bring it into our bodies, isn't it? And we can't put it into words all the time. And I think that's one of the things that that is hard about showing people the benefits of nature connection work and therapy in the outdoors is that we can't always demonstrate in evaluations of exactly what it means. But for me, just knowing that we are introducing people, children and adults, to the natural world, which will always be there for them no matter what happens in their lives. We can always find, whether you're in the city or where, you know, there's always a tree to go to or a park to go to where you can actually sit and listen to the birds, watch the trees turn colour, you know, in autumn, watch the buds grow in spring, and just be really embodied in how we experience that and therefore life. And I think often a lot of the resistance, a lot of the troubles that I see children having is a resistance to change, a resistance to, or maybe not, maybe resistance is not the right word, but
I think there's a lot of anxiety about change. I mean, it's in terms of sort of child development, we know from research that transition points are very tricky for children who are in care, for example. But for actually the majority of children, for various reasons, transition points are quite tricky. And particularly in older children and teenagers, there's a lot of anxiety about change. You know, the teenage years is a period of change and unsettledness within us, because we're struggling with so many different aspects. There's our physical development, there's our peer development, you know, are we like our friends, are we different to them? So there's all those tensions. I think what we do know is that the level of resilience that you have is what enables you to cope with any challenging situation or contributes to your abilities to cope to it. And in terms of children's play and in relation to transitions, I think one of the things that has been reduced in recent times is that what's commonly known now as risky play, which I always think is rather an odd term, because in many ways all play is risky. If it's not physically risky, it can be psychologically risky in a sense, because we are in play, we're putting our kind of inner self out there. And there seems to have been a kind of sanitization of children's worlds. Now, we're all familiar with the notion that health and safety's gone mad, but I think that there's a lot of perception of danger for young children and for young teenagers, some of which is very real, but some of which is almost imagined. And there's a kind of collective view that the world is a very dangerous place for children. And so everything has been sanitized. So lots of play has actually been marketized and sanitized and made so safe that actually it eliminates all risk. And it's only through taking a risk and coming out the other side of it that helps to build our resilience. I know you've got young children, and I know from our conversations that they spend time in the woods exploring mud and trees and everything. So I guess you'll understand that free play, that wild, risky play, is what is really critical to young people's development, to children's development. And also actually to adults, because as grown-ups we've kind of become very sanitized and no more so than at the moment, where we're so acutely aware of having to be very careful and wash our hands and stay a safe distance away and wrap our sneezes in tissues and throw them in the bin. And all those things are right and proper in our current situation. But I think we have to be very careful that we don't, as a society, first of all, communicate unnecessary anxiety to children and young people about how dangerous the world is, and thereby assume that they will all be irreparably damaged by COVID. Some will have been, some will have had a very negative experience of being at home, but many children will have had a very positive time being at home with parents who they may not see quite so much. But in sanitizing play and in giving that message that the world is a really dangerous place, we take away those opportunities to explore the way our body fits into space. What is our body? What are our bodies capable of? Now, how far can we stretch? How high can we go? How high can we jump?
Yes, yeah, I'm absolutely with you, and on so many levels, actually. I mean, I hold space for children where we create opportunities for what we call managed risk taking, and even that is, you know, is different to what children have always traditionally experienced, which is unsupervised play, where they get to try all of these things. And we're trying to recreate that environment where children do get to climb trees, they do get to sit with fires, they do get to use tools, and sometimes in the course of those actions things happen and we try and minimize the damage, but they do. And but children, they do get so much from that, and it's more than what they normally get. So I feel really proud of being able to do that. And for my children, certainly, there's been times where my daughter, who's could climb before she could walk, was up a tree and she fell out of the tree, and she climbed up the tree again and she fell out of the tree. And my parents were watching, and they were just absolutely gobsmacked that I was letting her get back up into the tree again. But I said, if I stop her going back up the tree, then she'll become scared of the tree. She wants to get up the tree. And that's why she's crying, not because she fell. And so she now has a very, and that was when she was, she could have been 3 or 4 actually, when she was doing that. But I was really keen that she learned to manage risk assess herself for herself. What does she feel safe? And that's my number one phrase whenever I'm watching my children and others. Does that feel safe to you? Rather than get down off there or that's too high, it's like, does that feel safe, really? Have you seen that branch? Does it look like it's still living? Because, you know, and supporting them to notice what things might be unsafe. And I absolutely love the power of that, and what children learn from doing all of those things about their bodies, about what they're willing, about their boundaries, and about what they're willing to try and what they're not willing to try. So in the 8 Shields, which is one of the models that we work with, we call it their edges. What are a child's passions? What are their edges? And how can we support their passions to grow? And how can we support them to brave their edges, but in a way that suits them? And I love, you know, I love that. And the other thing that you mentioned there. Well, something, I'm going to hugely misquote the National Health and Safety exec, but I was at a conference once about nature deficit disorder, and I heard that risk and health and safety had actually become less crazy, actually. They're actually trying now and recognizing that there are benefits to taking risk. And there was this quote that I heard, and I really need to look at it because I've mentioned it a few times, where it was something like, if a child has an injury that does not result in death or permanent debilitating injury, then it was a pursuit worth taking. Something like this, you know, that we should be encouraging children to do things that they wouldn't normally do. And yes, we absolutely want to avoid permanent debilitating injuries and certainly death. But other things, they happen, don't they? And that's part of life. And I think sometimes we try and avoid at all costs, which is the situation we're in now, you know, with COVID, that we're trying, that millions, billions of people's of lives are being affected because we're trying at all costs to avoid death of the very vulnerable. And we could go down a certain track with this whole talk, but it's like we're risk and death averse, and actually, at what cost is my question, and I don't have an answer.
Yeah, it's quite a deep philosophical question, that. As
well. Yeah, don't
worry.
Probably
more than an hour's podcast.
Yeah,
but actually, something that I think you've kind of alluded to, possibly not even consciously, but is about the pressure that society puts on us as in order that we have to be almost perfect all the time. And obviously the most obvious manifestation of that is in terms of body image and conformity to predictable stereotypes, mm-hmm. around weight, around the way you look, the way you dress, and I think it extends to parenting as well, that, mm-hmm. that there's a massive amount of guilt can be piled onto parents, that if you allow anything to happen to your child, you must have been a bad parent. Mm-hmm. So I used to live in Bridport down in Dorset, which is near West Bay, which is a very quirky seaside place. Some of your people who listen to this may well know it. And along the back of the West Beach is a wall. So there's a promenade with a wall that is probably about 2.5 feet high, maybe 3 feet. And there is a steep drop down the other side onto a pebble beach. And I have witnessed parents whose children inevitably climb on a wall. A wall is there to be climbed on, I'm sorry. When you're a small person, it's higher than you are, and you want to get up there. And I've seen parents who almost scream at the child, get down from there because you'll fall. Mm-hmm. So as you've said, instantly the child is terrified of what might be the other side of doing that. And then I've seen parents who say, well, there's a big drop the other side, so I need to hold your hand and I'll walk you along the wall. And it's that's obviously the response that personally I think is the right one, as you've said, that we teach our children how to be safe. We provide them the opportunities to experiment with risk taking, but in a safe way. That's a parent's job, is to keep their children safe. Mm-hmm. It was my job as professionals when we're out in the in nature and outdoors with children, is to ensure they're safe. Mm-hmm. But that isn't to say that we have to stop them doing those adventurous, risky things. That is how we build our resilience. And I was thinking back to, because as you know, Leona, I'm quite long in the tooth now. And I was thinking back to my very free-range childhood, where we were kind of out the door in a big, big mixed-age group, and we trolled across the fields for, you know, within a mile or mile and a half radius from home. And the older children looked after the younger children. They were often our siblings, and they risk assessed situations for us. Mm-hmm. And provided the help that we needed to navigate a stream that was too wide for us to jump or too deep for our wellies. We did some remarkably stupid things at times. And I personally, as a child, was injured, not too dreadfully, but I've got a couple of injuries with scars that still remain. But the key thing about that was that we learned how to be together. We learned how to resolve any disputes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes physically, I have to say. Mm-hmm. But we also learned how to risk assess, because the older children did it for us. Mm-hmm. And we learned from watching them. So by the age of 7 or 8, I knew you test the water to see if it's going to come over the top of your wellies gradually, bit by bit, rather than just plowing across the stream. Mm-hmm. And all those things. And as well as kind of being sanitized now, I think play is quite solitary for a lot of children as well. Mm-hmm. And there isn't that capacity, partly because of the urbanization of green mm-hmm. space. There isn't always that capacity to roam safely with groups of children. Mm-hmm. And you and I both share a dislike of screens in that respect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to recall to mind a couple of children, because in the process of looking at play therapy actually taking place in the outdoors, mm-hmm. There were a couple of young people that actually showed me the way. And I think, you know, through my lifetime, I've come into contact with probably thousands of children as a teacher, as a specialist advisory teacher, and as a play therapist. And even at my ripe old age, they teach me so much. Mm-hmm. They really do. And many, many, many years ago, when I was a teacher in a primary school, the year six children always went to camp. Mm-hmm. And that was a camp up in a forest area. And they camped in huts up there, had campfires. And it was always the year six children that went. And I bravely said one year, I think our year one children would really benefit from that. And so I was able to get the head to agree to tack on an extra night at the camp after the year six children had gone. And we took a group of year one children up there. And one of them was an incredibly high flyer academically. She was streets ahead of her peers in maths and English, encouraged at home to be very academic. And I guess she had a very old head on a very small body, mm-hmm. if you understand that. And I found her one morning outside the hut, the dining hut, in a puddle. She was cuppied down, playing with the mud in a puddle. And I said, we need to come in now, because we have to get ready and get our wet weather gear on to go off into the woods. And she didn't want to come out of the puddle. And in fact, one of the assistants with us actually stayed with her. And she spent the most of the morning playing around that area, in and out of the muddy puddles with sticks and stones, and doing all that really early exploratory play that in the pursuit of kind of academia, her parents had not been able to, not felt the need to offer her that kind of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And she actually loved it. Mm-hmm. She was so happy. And that so many years ago, before I was even training, thinking of play therapy, that connection that we all need with that embodied sensory play, mm-hmm. really was brought home to me by that.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Actually, you know, I just brought my son home from the woods, and he's been in the woods every day since he was born, really. We've obviously has been dragged along with me, but even him, who's had as much mud play, puddle play as he's ever wanted, has come home today, 9.5 years old, head to foot, covered in mud, like thick, like I literally had to hose him down outside. And so it's not, you know, it's not just the ones who don't get it that need it. It's like they all, it's just such a good, important part of us knowing, feeling our bodies, getting to understand the textures and the, you know, and everything around us. And it's fun. It's just fun.
And I think you might work sometimes with adults in the wood. I don't generally, but I must admit I have a few ideas for away days for stressed teachers at the moment that is actually just about being somewhere where we can light a fire and sit round it and relax and maybe do some activities, maybe just be, because it's that just being. And I ran a training day, the first training day I ran around play therapy in the outdoors down in the house belonging to a friend of mine down in Sussex. And we spent a day on, or we spent part of the day on the beach. And I got them to do what I now realise is a sit spot, which I didn't realise at the time, was to go and find themselves just a spot on the beach to sit quietly and just be there. And they came back, just some of them in tears, saying, I haven't done that for years. I haven't just sat anywhere and looked and felt what it was like to just be outside and be in nature. And it's that really powerful connection that we have that has transcended through generations from time immemorial, that we are of the land and we need to sit on and with the land to really feel that kind of replenishment and that healing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very, very with you with that. Just something, there's something very primal about sitting. And for me, that was one of the biggest, most remarkable points in my learning, was when I actually stopped in nature and sat silently and alone. Even though I now know I'm never alone, because I'm with all the other non-humans that are around,
yeah.
You know, and that for me was really transformational. Actually, just blew my mind once that concept of that clicked with me. So yeah, I'm definitely with you with that and how powerful it can be.
Yeah, and in terms of sort of the pathway to the outdoor play therapy, which was a very anguished one for me in many ways, because we're so steeped in that idea about remaining in this contained space. And I think I spoke to you earlier about the kind of relational nature of stuff, that you know, the world works on relationships. And it took me a long time to have the confidence to actually accept that it was that relational element that was crucial within play therapy. Because when you train in anything, you're holding all the rules and the boundaries and the must-dos and should-haves in your head. And sometimes it's quite hard to be brave enough to step outside of that and think, no, intuitively, and because my clients are telling me, I need to do something different. You mentioned that you'd were reading one of my books, and in the first book, I think it's probably the one you've got, the green one.
Yeah.
There's a chapter at the back on Chloe, and Chloe was a child in a school for profound and multiple learning difficulties, who was a nonverbal communicator. And when I first came across her, she was lying in an area of grass, eating the leaves, and absolutely devoid of the sensory experiences that most young children have. She was, I don't know, when you lie on grass and eat leaves, somehow that's almost like primeval, isn't it? You are the animal other. And I worked with her in the playroom, and she used to walk, move around the playroom with her foot in a bowl, gathering up bits and pieces on the way. And then she would shuffle with the bowl over to the door and hang on the door handle and howl. And
wow.
It was in my fairly early days, and I was like, what is this about? And what it was about was that when she got distressed in the classroom situation, she used to go outside and sit in a bird's nest swing, mm-hmm. because she had the vestibular needs she had were that she moved. That for her, that kind of swinging movement was like our homeostasis, like our resting position. And I fought against that because I knew we had to stay in the playroom until my supervisor said, why? She's telling you what she needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved the work out into the bird's nest swing. And I cannot tell you the progress that girl made.
Was wow. just,
and actually culminating in her looking me straight in the eye and clapping her hands together
oh.
as she swung. And it was a really moving experience for me that cemented in my mind that what I thought was needed was right.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's right for the client, then we have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And well, and thank you for doing that. Wow. And taking that step and wrestling with, as you say, with what you've been taught and what you know to be the traditional or well-researched given approach, and then listening. And I think that's what being in nature, someone who's connected with nature like yourself, who spends a lot of time in nature, those of us who do, I do believe that if you're intentional about it, you then start to be able to really listen to yourself and really tune in to your own sense of what's right and wrong. And that's what we're giving to children, you know, just to be able to be in nature, to sit in silence, to just explore and be with what's there, really gives you a sense of what it's like to listen to your body and listen to your heart, listen to your mind, your thoughts. And when you're with a therapist, doing that together means that you get to then process that as well in a way that is different to what happens when you do it on your own. And I love it. I love the power, the transformational power of developing relationships with ourselves and with the natural world. And I'm really excited about where this is all going, and the number of people who are having these conversations now in many, across many professions, and excited. I've mentioned it before, but I'll mention it again, just because I think it's worth people knowing about that. The nature premium that the Forest School Association are pushing now is something that could be a really huge step towards making sure that all children get more access to nature as part of the curriculum, as part of the thing that, you know, that all children should have, just like the sports premium gave access to children and to schools, funding for schools for them to access more sports, that this could really support children. So for anybody who is interested in that, I'll put links in the show notes about the nature premium and how people can support that. And I wonder if you could let people know how people could find out more about the things we've talked about through you, Ali.
Well, COOPT, which is our Collaboration of Outdoor Play Therapist Network, we have a website on which I put a periodic, what I call blog post, and that is www.coopt.wordpress.com. And we also have a COOPT Facebook page, so people can follow us through there. If you're a play therapist and you're registered with BAP, the British Association of Play Therapists, then you can follow us on the BAPT forum or the BAPT members page.
Mm-hmm.
And I can always be contacted myself if people want to talk to me more about work or training or supervision at motherbird at www.coop.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
Or we have a Cooped email, which is cooped.uk@gmail.com.
Great. I will put all
those links. I'll check that last one, Leona, because yeah. I can't remember what to put in there.
Yeah.
I think it is cooped.uk@gmail.com.
Yeah. I'll put all of those links in the show notes, and then and people to the Facebooks and websites, and people can check them out. And I'll also put links to your books, the one that I've got, and you've got how many books?
I've got two books out at the moment: the Play Therapy in the Outdoors with Jessica Kingsley, which you've got. And its companion piece, which is the practical guide to play therapy in the outdoors, which will give anybody who's interested in starting some general pointers, and also goes into what the outdoors, how that impacts on young people's development. Mm-hmm. And we have I have a chapter of my own and a shared chapter with my colleague Penny McFarland, who's a drama therapist. Those are in a book that's coming out, I think, next month, in the International Handbook of Play Therapy. And my own chapter is entitled Oh Yes I Am, and looks at the idea, I think, which Julie was talking about at the weekend,
mm-hmm.
this idea that play therapy happens where the play therapist is,
mm-hmm.
and isn't constricted to the playroom. And Penny and I have written about the links with education and the need for training for teachers in not just attachment and trauma, but actually in really understanding where play therapy and drama therapy can fit into supporting young people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's being published by Routledge.
Lovely. Well, I'll also put links to those, and I love your book, so the one that I have, so maybe it's time that I get the other one as well, because I just can't stop. I think I have this belief that I will read all the books on my shelves through osmosis or something, because there's so many good things to read and keep up with these days.
Yeah, well, I'm the same. I have a bookshelves full of books I'm going to read when I retire.
Yeah.
And that day keeps moving.
Well, thank you so much. It's been really lovely to speak with you. I've loved meandering through our, what is clearly things that we're really passionate about, and also lucky enough to work with and be with in ourselves, as well as in the work that we do. So, thank you so much. And it's been lovely to speak to you.
Well, thanks, Leona, and it's been grand to be here, and also to get to know you and your work, and I hope we'll work together more in the future.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I hope it inspires you to follow your path of deep connection. I love sharing this information so much, and I'll always share any relevant links in my show notes. If you like the show, please consider supporting it at patreon.com/connectionmatterspodcast. This is where you'll find bonus episodes, giveaways, and behind-the-scenes content from me, as well as having my huge heartfelt thanks for any support that you can give me. It really helps with the viability of the show. You can get most of what will be on offer for as little as £3 per month. Please also subscribe on whatever app you use by clicking that little subscribe button below. That way you'll get all of the upcoming episodes straight into your device. And please leave a review on iTunes. It's so helpful to our ratings. The music that opens and closes the show is actually by my very own dad, Ray Johnson. Thanks, Dad. And you can hear more of his music at soundcloud.com/visionray.